Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your Sun Sounds volunteer reader, presenting the major news articles from the Monday, August 17th, 2026 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's check out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather: sunny to partly cloudy, a stray shower or thunderstorm is possible. Highs to 106 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east to northeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight's weather: partly cloudy skies, stray shower or thunderstorm is possible. Lows to 81 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts generally sunny despite a few afternoon clouds. A stray shower or thunderstorm is possible. Highs around 105 degrees Fahrenheit, winds east-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Now from the Arizona Daily Star front page, the first article is titled, Drinking Wells Keep Drying Up in Wilcox Area. This article was written by Tony Davis of the Arizona Daily Star. For homeowner Hazard Hawk, it was a case of three strikes and his well was out. He and his wife Deborah had to abandon their well in Cochise County's Dragoon Mountains foothills last February after sediment built up in it and browned its water so heavily that they felt it was unfit for them and their four horses to drink. 3 years earlier, they had a well company install a new set of pipes for the well after it had also been filled with sediment. 15 years ago, the previous owner of the home where they live in Cochise County subdivision of Richland had drilled the well 200 feet deeper after it dried up. This time around, their well driller, Brian Allen, came over and said, "Your well is dead," Hawk recalls. He came in and tried to pull out the pump. The ground was moving, and he said, "Once we get a 50,000-pound pump moving, no telling where it will go." So now they're paying a water hauling company $200 every 3 weeks to truck 2,500 gallons to their home, lying 3 miles east of the Dragoon Mountains in the Wilcox Basin. Hawks did well at company. Not long after Allen told the Hawks their well was useless, he gave similar bad news to two other households nearby, all within a mile of each other, Allen told the Star. Around the entire Wilcox Basin, estimates are that more than 100 drinking wells had dried up in recent years. Regulators from the Arizona Department of Water Resources have proposed cutting water use by farms, by far the basin's largest water user, by 10% to reduce the pressure on the area's long-depleted aquifer. But activists working on this issue say it will take a bigger cut than that to keep more wells from drying up. One of the other Richland residents who lost a well, Randy Redhawk, today drives 5 miles to Sun Sounds regularly to fill his truck with water served at a station run by a private company that has its own well. "That water tastes terrible because it contains excessive chlorine and fluoride," he said, "so he uses it only for washing and for giving water to these animals." To get his drinking water, Redhawk drives 4 miles every 6 weeks to a friend's house that has a good well and fills 6 5-gallon plastic bottles with water. He recalled that back in the spring, the ground collapsed on his and some other neighboring wells. Prior to that, his well delivered 26 gallons a minute, but then it slowed to a trickle of maybe 1 gallon per hour, Redhawk said. A month later, the well went totally out, he said. "We lost all of our wells," he said, "of those belonging to him and his Richland neighbors. The pumps got covered due to the subsistence," he said, "in which the ground sinks after overpumping removes water from the soil's pores." Well driller Allen said that all three wells he saw stopped working. The ground is moving down there. For all three of them, the well casing broke. He was referring to a tubular structure typically made of steel or PVC materials that lines the inside of the well. It serves as a watertight protective lining, offers structural support, and prevents the well from being contaminated by sediments and bacteria. "People keep moving into our valley, sucking water out, and when the ground sinks, it moves. It's breaking the casings," Allen said. Lou Menuda, president of a group that tries to help Wilcox area owners of dried up wells to get new wells, said he talked to owners of 12 Richland wells, including Hawk and Redhawk, that stopped working over a six-week period earlier this year due to excessive sedimentation of pumps. "The well owners live within a 2-mile radius of one another," he said. All those cases occurred in Richland, a sparsely populated area. It lies 7 miles north of Sunsites, an unincorporated community of 600 to 800 residents, 27 miles southwest of the city of Wilcox. Those well casings were probably being damaged from crunching and twisting caused by compaction of the ground from subsistence, in which overpumping of groundwater causes the ground to sink, said Brian Conway, an Arizona Department of Water Resources hydrogeologist. He regularly tracks subsistence patterns in the Wilcox Basin. In the Richland Sunsites area, the ground sinks from the subsistence by about 2 inches a year, he said. Subsidence in the subsurface that leads to the sediment being able to get into the well casing. That's one of the telltale signs that the casings are damaged. The casing is the critical part that allows the water but keeps sediment out, Conway said. Menuda is president of People for the Play of Water Resources, a nonprofit group that's trying to help basin residents which failed wells get new ones through an $11 million well replacement program established by the Wilcox Basin mega dairy company Riverview LLP. The program was set up following a legal settlement reached in early 2026 between Minnesota-based Riverview, which owns two large dairies in the basin, and Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays. And while the well owners await responses to their applications for new wells, it can take 3 months to process. Menuda's group says a Sunsites-based water company to haul water to their houses. In each instance, there was still some water in the well, Menuda said, of the 12 Richland well owners. The problem is the pumps got clogged. State officials took the first step this month towards curbing the Wilcox Basin chronic groundwater overdraft, following more than a decade of building anger and anguish debate over water use in drying wells in the basin. ADWR has proposed to require most farmers in the 1,911 square mile basin covering parts of Cochise and Graham counties cut their water use by 10% starting in 2029. But already Steve Kisiel, leader of an activist group in the basin called Cochise Groundwater Stewards, said he's received anecdotal accounts of easily more than 100 wells in the basin that had to be deepened after they've gone dry. And he warns that if agricultural pumping isn't cut significantly fairly soon and wells levels keep falling at their current pace, he believes virtually every residential well in the Wilcox Basin will go dry in 25 to 40 years. The reason is the huge overdraft, almost exclusively attributed to agricultural irrigation, will continue to deplete the aquifer and lower water levels, said Kisiel, whose group works to assure the preservation of our precious groundwater. The drought only makes things worse, he said. Everyone here knows, or should know, it's just a matter of when, not if, their well will run out of water. Kisiel cites figures from maps in ADWR's 313-page proposed management plan that show large concentrations of monitored wells, saw major declines from 1990 through 2021. In various parts of the basin and over various periods, wells have dropped 3 to 13 feet a year. Noting these declines, Kisiel said, most domestic wells in the basin are drilled 150 to 200 feet below where they first hit good water. Even if a well is drilled with that cushion today, the well would likely run out of water in less than 40 years. Christine Uhlman, a retired University of Arizona hydrologist who has done water studies in the Wilcox Basin, agreed with Kisiel's projections, adding, my experience with Kisiel is that he digs deep and he does the math. His numbers are good. ADWR didn't respond to the Star's request to comment on Kisiel's projections. Menuda said it's only getting worse, so many wells have gone dry in the past few months. Most people can't afford new wells. Without a really strong and forceful management plan, it's only going to accelerate. People run the companies that try to service Hawks well and that now haul water to his home say they too are seeing plenty of residential wells go dry in the basin. ADWR reported 2 years ago it has records of 71 wells that have dried up there since the department formed in 1980 and 29 of them have gone dry since 2014. But the department and people living in the basin have never conducted an official basin-wide survey of dried-out wells, leaving the actual total uncertain. Desert Water Delivery, which hauls water to the Hawks, delivers water to a total of 50 to 75 households in Cochise County, said the company's owner, Ben Hips. We get more customers all the time. We also set up pumps for people as well. We're setting up water systems for people who can be served by us, Hips said. I'm not the only dog in town. I know for sure of two other companies here that haul water, but my understanding is I cover more of a customer base than they do. There's also a lot of people who haul for themselves. I represent people who don't have equipment to haul for themselves, he said. Brian Allen, whose family has run a well drilling service in Cochise County for half a century, said he's either drilling new wells or deepening existing wells in the basin twice a week, and that 70% of his company's drilling is for new wells. We've been drilling wells forever. It is what it is. It doesn't rain, it doesn't snow. If people want to bitch that's farmers and ranchers sucking up water, they need to go back to where they came from, said Allen, whose family owns Allen's Well Drilling Service in Elfrida, just south of the Wilcox Basin near the city of Douglas. My family has been here since the 30s. There's been water issues here for 40 years. Hawk, however, said he's in the Wilcox Basin to stay. We're too old to pack up and move again, said Hawk, who's 77. And whose wife is 75. He said the previous owner of his property had drilled a well 200 feet deep in 1993. The owners deepened it another 200 feet in 2011 after it went dry, Hawk said. The Hawks bought the house with its well in February 2020 after moving down from Paulden north of Prescott because they were getting tired of that area's continued growth and increased traffic, he said. They had no problems with it until April 2023, when the pump filled with sediment the first time, he said. Today, life with the hauled water is more difficult than with their now abandoned well, but they have no plans to seek help from the Riverview Fund to drill a new well, Hawk said. We're both retired, both on Social Security. We're doing very good, and other families need outside help more than they do, Hawk said. Red Hawk, however, says he's still waiting to hear back on his application for money from Riverview to drill a new well 3 months after he requested it. To date, Riverview has financed new wells for 17 families at a cost of $389,483, the Attorney General's office said. But that money all came from a fund that set aside half of the $11 million to help families living within 1.5 miles of either of those dairies. Red Hawk and Hawk live much further away, well to the west of the dairies. They would be eligible to receive money from a separate Riverview fund managed by the Arizona Community Foundation, but Red Hawk said he's heard nothing from the foundation since submitting his application. The foundation didn't return a call from the Star inquiring about the fund. Menudo said foundation officials have told him they've had some delays setting up their part of the well funding program. That's in part because the foundation decided to hire a hydrogeologist to review estimates from well drillers of the cost of drilling the residents' new wells. Today, the foundation has 40 to 50 applications that have just been sitting there, Manula said. While waiting results on his application, Redock said he uses an outhouse instead of his toilet to save water at the trailer where he lives on his 10-acre property. He rents a house on his property to longtime friends, and they have saved water by getting rid of some of their animals, taking their clothes to the laundromat instead of using their washing machine, he said. He had fed himself for years with crops he grew at the community garden on his property, he said. But this year his well gave out just after he dug seeds for his summer crops. I just let everything die. That's hard for me, Red Hawk said. I've always grown my own food. I haven't been able to grow anything for 6 months now. The title of the next front page article is Iran Could Further Criminalize Hostile Media Interviews. This article was written by Reuters, Dateline Dubai. Iran's parliament approved a bill on Sunday that would criminalize interviews and other communications with media deemed hostile to the Islamic Republic, including U.S. or Israeli Israel media and outlets financed by either country, Iran's Sarg newspaper reported. Under the bill, which must be reviewed by the Guardian Council before it can become law, interviews or participation in discussions with such media would be banned in violations punishable by 6 months to 2 years in prison. Interviews with other foreign media could require notification to the intelligence ministry, while contact with foreign embassies, offices of foreign organizations, and other non-Iranian institutions without notification and written permission from the foreign ministry would be punishable by a fine and deprivation of certain social rights. The bill would also harden penalties for economic crimes committed under the direction of supervision of foreigners, ban providing information to foreigners without intelligence ministry approval, and restrict scientific cooperation with foreign institutions outside an approved list. It would punish policy or legislative proposals made under the direction of foreign intelligence services if they harm Iran's security or independence with prison terms of up to 30 years. Cases would be heard by revolutionary courts. The move does not mark the first time Iran has criminalized cooperation with foreign entities. A law passed in 2025 after a 12-day war with Israel imposed tougher penalties for alleged cooperation with hostile states. Iranian photojournalist Yelda Moryaier was sentenced this month to 15 years under that law over allegations that included giving interviews to media deemed hostile and providing photographs to U.S. and Israeli-linked organizations. The next front page article is titled Immigration Hearings Go Mega. This article was written by Christopher Kahn, Isabel Folland, and Mary Ann Carruth of the USA Today Network. Lines stretched out the front door of courthouses. Overflow seating was set up in hallways. Classroom-style exchanges with judges asking people to raise their hands in response to generic questions about their cases. These are some of the scenes playing out on immigration courts across the country as the Trump administration increasingly turns to mass hearings in an effort to push more cases through the cumbersome immigration system. These so-called mega master hearings, which pack upwards of 50 to 100 cases in a single proceeding, are meant to cut down on the large backlog of cases in immigration courts run by the Justice Department, federal officials say. Critics argue the effort slashes the already limited due process that immigrants receive, giving them less meaningful time before a judge. The hearings, which have ticked up since May, come as detentions and deportations have surged in recent weeks, according to data from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It also comes as the administration has made it easier for immigration authorities to deny asylum claims. Meanwhile, more children are being brought in front of immigration judges for mass hearings, including unaccompanied minors, legal observers say. The controversial hearings are preliminary in nature and offer individuals an opportunity to enter pleas or request relief, such as asylum. They are similar to arraignments in criminal court and are typically the first time people appear before an immigration judge, but while master's hearings with 20 to 30 people have been commonplace for years, the sheer size of these recent hearings is concerning immigration attorneys who describe them as intentionally rushed and chaotic. One of the central concerns is that immigrants are having their scheduled court dates moved up months or years, leaving them little time to prepare for the hearings. Critics also say the quick pace of the proceedings, coupled with confusion over how they operate, has meant more people are missing their court dates. Those who don't show up are often subject to removal orders. This will push many more people into deportation proceedings, said Mustafa Chishti, a senior fellow with the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. Supporters say the effort could cut down the more than 3.4 million cases pending in immigration court, which has long been strained by severe backlogs. This is a very effective way to reduce the backlog, said Matt O'Brien, a former immigration judge and the deputy executive director of Federation for American Immigration Reform, a group that advocates for stricter limits on immigration. In a statement, the Department of Justice said, reducing the immigration court backlog remains one of the highest priorities for his administration. The Justice Department is restoring integrity over to our immigration system by hearing cases fairly, expeditiously, and uniformly in accordance with the law. Master hearings are short proceedings in which judges review the government charges and ask what, if any, legal relief an immigrant is seeking, as well as whether they have legal counsel. The judge will then schedule hearings where a request for asylum and other forms of relief are litigated. In recent months, immigration attorneys have reported a sharp increase in the number of large-scale master hearings in immigration courts across the country, from Iowa and Texas to New Jersey and Massachusetts. Over 1,300 such hearings were held in June alone, a nearly threefold jump from the same period in 2025, according to data analyzed by Mobile Parkways, a nonprofit that tracks immigration court data. Joseph Perez, an immigration attorney based in Virginia, said he's had clients in hearings with 20 to 30 other people. These smaller hearings are more typical, and he described them as manageable, not only for immigrants, but for judges and staff, too. These larger hearings go on all day, he told USA Today. It's unreasonable. In Chicago, immigration lawyers described hearings with nearly 200 people before a single immigration judge. Respondents crowded the hallways and the inside of courtrooms. Once the proceedings began, the ones in the back struggled to hear judges as they asked questions like, "How many of you have a lawyer, and are you claiming asylum?" The sheer scale of these mega master hearings is truly unprecedented, said Kiki Mosley, chair of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, at the July news conference in Chicago. Some supporters of the larger hearings are concerned that the format could cause immigration judges to burn out. "There is a danger there," said Andrew Arthur, a resident fellow in law and policy at the Conservative Center for Immigration Studies. Burnout is what happened to former immigration judge Elizabeth Treacy, who resigned June 22nd after presiding over three large master hearings in Chicago that each listed between 130 and 150 people. "Whenever you have a high volume of anything in any field, it leaves a possibility for error because of fatigue and because of the repetitive nature of what you're reviewing," Treacy told WBEZ Chicago. "I never wanted to make a mistake in those kind of circumstances." In a statement, the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which oversees immigration courts under DOJ, said it prioritizes the timely completion of all cases and makes scheduling adjustments as needed to ensure cases do not languish. "Unnecessary delay hurts both alien with meritorious claims and the American public, who wish to see aliens with non-meritorious claims removed as quickly as possible," it added. "As it continues to add new immigration judges, EOIR will continue to make scheduling adjustments to ensure all cases are handled in a timely and lawful manner." These mass hearings have coincided with a sharp increase in the number of cases ruled in absentia, meaning the judge issued deportation orders after someone failed to appear in court. Of the 10,370 people assigned to hearings in June, 58% were ruled absent, according to Justice Department data analyzed by Mobile Pathways. Mosley and other immigration lawyers said officials provided little notice to people whose court dates were moved up by several months or, in some cases, years. Advocates said some didn't show up because they're scared of being arrested inside the courthouse, a tactic the Trump administration employed for months before it was blocked from doing so last year. Other immigrants allegedly showed up but were issued removal orders because of the chaos in the courthouse. "We have witnessed immigrants by being ordered removed for missing their court dates, not because they did not come to court, but they arrived on time and amid overcrowding and confusion could not find the correct courtroom or hear their case being called," Mosley said. Immigration attorneys said Trump administration is relying on the high rates of absentia orders to close cases, issue removal orders, and funnel more immigrants into deportation proceedings. University of Iowa law student Chase McLaren attended what's believed to be a first mega master hearing in Omaha, Nebraska. McLaren said the judge issued orders in a rapid-fire manner. "Every person who did not attend the day's hearing received deportation orders," McLaren told the Des Moines Register, part of the USA Today network. Andrew Arthur, a resident fellow in law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies, largely pins the high number of in absentia orders on the Biden administration, which he said failed to properly screen undocumented immigrants at the border. Arthur also said the federal government has the burden of proving that they served a hearing notice at an immigrant's last known address. If the government fails to do that and someone is ordered removed because they didn't show up, the respondent can move to reopen the case. There's a lot of due process built into the system, he said. Immigration courts are experiencing a backlog of over 3.4 million cases as of June, according to the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which oversees immigration courts. That number is down from 3.7 million a year earlier and a high of 3.9 million under the last year of the Biden administration, which oversaw a more than doubling of the immigration court backlog since 2021, according to government data. They've made great progress at driving down the backlog, Arthur said of the Trump administration, noting that the number of pending cases decreased in fiscal year 2025 for the first time in over a decade. To expand its mass deportation agenda, the administration has also carried out a record hiring spree of immigration judges, many of whom have past ties with the federal government and lack immigration law experience, records show. For example, all the immigration judges working cases in Omaha have served as legal counsel for ICE within the last decade, with some serving in this capacity months before their appointment, the Des Moines Register found. Immigration judges are part of the executive branch and are appointed by the U.S. Attorney General rather than being confirmed by the Senate. Immigration attorneys and legal experts have criticized the administration for what they call partisan hiring practices that emphasize loyalty to the president's agenda over objective decision-making. The Executive Office for Immigration Review said it evaluates all immigration judges, regardless of background, on factors such as conduct, impartiality, adherence to the law, productivity, and professionalism. The office added that all judges have a legal, ethical, and professional obligation to be impartial and neutral in adjudicating cases. The next front page article is titled Giles Talks Abortion and Vouchers. This article was written by Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Dateline, Mesa. The nominee for attorney, or rather Arizona lieutenant governor, on the Democratic ticket says he sees no conflict between having declared himself pro-life in 2024 and months later voting for a state constitutional amendment that allows women to terminate a pregnancy up until fetal viability. I voted for it, John Giles says. It accurately reflects my personal point of view on the topic. In his first news conference since being tapped by Governor Katie Hobbs as a running mate, the former Mesa mayor also said vouchers for private and parochial school tuition are here to stay, but that more funding is needed for public schools, and also called efforts to save the Republican Party, where he was registered until earlier this year when he switched to independent, a lost cause. Also said the policy differences between him and Hobbs are remarkably little or nothing, saying both are focused on nonpartisan issues such as economic development, education, and public safety. Giles dismissed a question asking his position on biological boys using restrooms and locker rooms designated for girls, calling it a red herring. He pointed out that in 2021, as mayor, he helped push through a wide-ranging ordinance that prohibits discrimination in public accommodations, employment, and housing, not just on the basis of race, color, or ethnicity, but also sexual orientation, gender, and gender identity. The measure drew complaints from some residents who argued it would put women and children at risk, some of the same arguments that occur at the Arizona Capitol amid legislative debates about who can use which restroom. Giles responded at the time that the ordinance would not make Mesa restrooms fearful places where men posing as women could lurk. Privacy is a reasonable concern, he said. As a father of four daughters and a grandfather, I would never put them in danger. And now, the Mesa ordinance has been in place for several years now. He said there's never been a situation like that that has been brought forward. the weekend press conference with Hobbs following a campaign rally at Giles Mesa law office was the first time political reporters had a chance to extensively question Giles about his positions on statewide issues. Hobbs, by virtue of her time as a legislator, Secretary of State, and then as governor for the last few years, has an extensive public record. Republican nominee for Governor Andy Biggs has 14 years of state legislative votes plus actions he has taken since being elected to Congress in 2016. His running mate, Cyan Kerr, got into Arizona legislature in 2018 as a Republican appointee and served until deciding not to seek re-election in 2024. Giles, by contrast, has a political career confined to Mesa, first as a council member, then as a mayor. He did get into the wider political limelight in 2024 when, as a Republican, he spoke at the Democratic National Convention. In an interview with CNN at the time, Giles explained he remained registered with the GOP because he was more comfortable in terms of political positions for the Republican Party than I am in the Democratic Party. Reasons included what he said was advocacy by some Democrats for open borders. He also cited the abortion issue. I continue to be pro-life, he said. Yet Giles acknowledged that just 4 months later, he voted for Proposition 139. That initiative enshrined a provision in the Arizona Constitution saying there is a fundamental right to abortion. It also barred any state registration on that right prior to fetal viability. Generally considered between 22 and 24 weeks, absent in a compelling state interest that is archived by the least restrictive means. It also said the state cannot interfere with abortions after that point if a treating healthcare professional says it is necessary to protect the life or physical or mental health of the pregnant individual. Giles said his views on the issues were affected by the 2022 ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court that overturned the historic 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade that there was a constitutional right to abortion. Arizona was confronted with a pre-statehood ban on abortion, Giles noted. That's because an 1864 state law outlawing abortion had never been repealed after the 1973 decision. A judge ruled, and the Arizona Supreme Court affirmed that with Roe now overturned, the 1864 law could once again be enforced. Giles said that unlike Biggs and Kerr, who have long record of opposition to legalize abortion, I did not support that. But by the time Proposition 139 came along, the question was no longer of one of having to choose between an initiative's provisions and the outlawing of abortion in Arizona. State lawmakers voted in May 2024 to repeal the territorial era ban. That meant the state of the law by that November election was that abortions were legal in Arizona until the 15th week of pregnancy. Proposition 139, approved by voters by a 2-to-1 margin, superseded that with its new standard removing state restrictions prior to viability. Giles said he remains convinced of his support of the initiative was and is justified. More importantly, it reflects the will of the Arizona voters and it reflects the current state of the Constitution of Arizona, he said. That relates directly to the current campaign, he said. If I'm ever in a position to defend 139 and new state constitution protections after for that, I will do so, Giles said. Strictly speaking, state law does not give the newly created position of lieutenant governor any specific powers. Instead, the voter-approved law directs the governor to find a role in government for a lieutenant governor, presumably heading a state agency. But the power of a governor would pass to the running mate if an incumbent governor died in office, quit, or was forced out through criminal indictment or by impeachment and removal by the legislature. Things that have happened in the last 50 years in Arizona. Biggs and Kerr are both on record as opposing abortion and opposing Proposition 139, but since the gubernatorial campaign began, both said they will respect the will of the voters and not try to have it overturned. But Biggs is also a co-sponsor of H.R. 72, which would extend the definition of a human being to include pre-born. And that federal law, if approved, could override Arizona constitutional protections. Giles also was asked about those, including Hobbs, who have pushed to eliminate the system approved by Republican lawmakers in 2022, which allows any student to get an Empowerment Scholarship account, tax dollars of $7,500 per year, to attend private or parochial schools or be homeschooled. Prior to then, the funding had been reserved for students with special needs, including disabilities. Being a foster child attending a public school rated D or F, or being a child in a military family. The change to universal access in the name of school choice boosted the program from 12,000 students to now over 100,000 students with a $1 billion annual price tag. In our first year in office, Hobbs got no traction in asking that the 2022 law be repealed. She has done no better with subsequent proposals to curb the program, including placing income limits on families. Now, two groups, the Arizona Education Association and Save Our Schools Arizona, are pushing Proposition 212. It contains restrictions on how the money can be spent and includes a $150,000 cap on family income. Giles said he supports the initiative. School choice, that's toothpaste out of the tube, he said. Said Giles, we're going to continue to support school choice. But he said he remains a strong advocate for public education, noting his father was a school principal in Mesa for 30 years. His mother was a teacher and his children are school teachers and principals. I think that for there to be true, meaningful school choice, the public option has to be a strong one, Giles said. Public education has to have the resources that it needs to compete. Giles, born in 1960, was unapologetic about having registered Republican. I was drawn to the Republican Party because of my admiration for people like John McCain, because of a belief in limited government and free enterprise, he said. That's never changed. Giles also remained registered with the GOP even as he believes the party changed, saying he felt he needed to be there to advocate for people like myself that were being shoved out of the party. A few months ago, I realized that's a lost cause right now, Giles said. So independent is a good place for me to be, he said. It accurately describes where I am politically. Now we'll pause to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I am a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles. The title of the first article is Fed Plan Prompts Warning. This article was written by Brandon Loomis of the Arizona Republic. Arizona continues pressing its case against potentially catastrophic cuts in its water supply, asserting that the federal government is developing a plan for the Colorado River, ignores critical legal requirements to deliver water to the Southwest. As the U.S. Interior Department puts the finishing touches on rules that would determine the next 2 years of supply for Arizona, California, and Nevada, Arizona Water Resources Director Tom Buschutsky wrote to warn officials they are not following the law and could set off a court battle if they don't change course. In a 10-year framework, the agency says it may reduce deliveries to the three states by up to 3 million acre-feet a year if conditions are poor enough to require it. Buschutsky wrote to Interior on August 10th to say that such a massive cut ignores the 1922 Colorado River Compact and that Arizona reserves the right to seek resolution of its compact rights in an appropriate judicial forum. The compact promised the three states comprising the river's low basin 7.5 million acre-feet a year, a figure that those states have offered to dip below, but by a lesser account than what the government may authorize, and only if the four upper basin states also commit to mandatory cuts. So far, those states haven't agreed, and they have argued that they can't be blamed for violating the compact when it's climate change and the lower basin overuse that drained water from Lake Powell and Lake Mead. The lack of basin-wide agreement led the Interior Department to devise its own plan. Getting the lower basin 7.5 million acre-feet traditionally has required releasing more than 8 million acre-feet from Lake Powell, so there's enough extra to satisfy Mexico's needs. The new federal plan envisions releases as of little as 5 million acre-feet in bad years, or as much as 12 million in exceptionally wet years. The government's new plan says it may use upper basin reservoirs to aid in deliveries to Lake Powell, but does not specify how much. Arizona expressly reserves its right to demand that the party states and the federal government adhere to the Colorado River Compact and the law of the river in terms of both the party states' water usage and the federal government's operation of federal facilities upstream of Lee's Ferry. Bushetsky wrote in his letter to Andrea Trevnicek, the Assistant Interior Secretary overseeing the development of the new rules to govern the river. Arizona recognizes that the department has broad authority to establish operational guidelines for Colorado River infrastructure, he wrote, but that authority does not displace the legal obligations imposed by the compact. Interior Department officials did not immediately respond to requests for comment. As of August 12th, it remained unclear of how much a supply cut in the states would face for the first 2 years under the new system, 2027 and 2028. Arizona and its lower basin partners had proposed cutting back by 1.25 million acre-feet a year during that period and incentivizing users to save still more. Interior is expected to announce a two-year operation plan this month and then update it to match current conditions every 2 years. The three states only offered those cuts for a two-year period to enable continued negotiations for a longer-term deal between all seven states, Bushetsky said. One that would satisfy the compact's requirements. They had not intended to make a running offer to last the length of the federal plan's 10-year framework. Arizona does not agree to a preferred alternative framework longer than 2 years, he wrote. A deputy assistant secretary called into a Glen Canyon Dam Environmental Advisory Committee meeting in Flagstaff to speak on behalf of Trevnicek, whom he said remained busy in talks over the two-year guidelines. Those rules will respond to hydrologic conditions and provide flexible tools to protect critical infrastructure at Glen Canyon Dam and Hoover Dam, while incorporating the voluntary arrangements submitted from the lower basin states and feedback from the upper division states, tribes, and stakeholders. Deputy Assistant Secretary Dustin Scherer said, together they provide for reliable operations of the Colorado River system, delivery of vital water supplies while preserving the flexibility necessary to respond to basin states' voluntary actions, consensus directives, and the continuing prolonged drought. While Interior has not said it will immediately impose 3 million acre-feet of cuts, only that it could do so if conditions require it over the next decade. Bushetsky wrote that such a slashing of the lower basin's share of the river is out of line when Interior is only seeking voluntary reductions from the upstream states and only up to 200,000 acre-feet. Reductions of the magnitude under considerations by the department far exceed what the lower division states have offered, and if ever implemented, would inflict catastrophic harm to Arizona citizens without any corresponding mandatory contribution from the upper division states, Bushetsky wrote. Shortages may not be imposed on the lower basin to absorb a deficiency that exists because the upper division states have not met the delivery obligations or that releases from the upper basin reservoirs would remedy. Interior has said it will issue its two-year guidelines in August in time to direct dam releases when the new water year begins on October 1st. States and tribes initially expected the announcement at the start of the month, but on August 12th, the wait and behind-the-scenes discussions continued. The next Tucson and Region section article is titled Lawsuit, Doctor Inseminated Patients. This article was written by Stephanie Innes of the Arizona Republic. A physician living in Scottsdale is accused in a lawsuit of secretly and maliciously inseminating multiple patients with his own sperm. The legal action filed August 6th in Wisconsin Circuit Court says that Joseph Latke Hyder, 43, recently discovered through Ancestry.com that Dr. Frederick Detman is his biological father and that he has multiple half-siblings. Hyder discovered his connection to Detman after submitting a DNA sample to Ancestry.com, which revealed multiple half-siblings and a direct genetic connection to Detman's family, according to the lawsuit. Hyder filed the lawsuit, which alleges negligence, deception, and emotional distress, among other things, along with his mother, Mary Ellen Lukiewicz. Formerly known as Mary Ellen Lutke, in this lawsuit, Lukiewicz says she's been led to believe her son was conceived with donor sperm from an anonymous medical student. Detman lives in Scottsdale and, according to the Arizona Medical Board, has an active physician's license, though there is no practice associated with his license. Detman's legal team on August 14th did not immediately respond to the Arizona Republic's request for comment. Medical board records say that Detman graduated from medical school in Wisconsin in 1960 and that he completed a residency in obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington Hospital in Seattle in 1962, and that he completed a fellowship in the gynecological oncology at Ohio State University Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, in 1965. Sean Gaynor, with Milwaukee-based Gaynor Law Group, said in a statement to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in June, when the allegations first surfaced, that Detman is aware of the family's claims, but because of the HIPAA and Wisconsin medical confidentiality laws, he cannot comment on any patient care he rendered during his career. The events referenced are alleged to have occurred almost 50 years ago, Gaynor told the Journal Sentinel. Dr. Detman has no dependent recollection of the individuals making these allegations and is unaware of any evidence supporting the claims being asserted. The complaint filed by lawyers for Hyder and Lukiewicz from Brookfield, Wisconsin law firm Cannon and Dunphy says that Detman was treating Lukiewicz for infertility in the 1980s when she was in her 20s. After unsuccessful fertility medicine and surgery, Detman suggested artificial insemination with a donor sperm and told Lukiewicz the sperm was from an anonymous, healthy young medical student, the lawsuit alleges. Detman further represented that the identity of the donor would be unknown to Mrs. Lukiewicz and that Mrs. Lukiewicz's identity would be unknown to the donor, the lawsuit said. Dr. Detman, without the knowledge or consent of Mrs. Lukiewicz, and contrary to his specific representation to her, did not use sperm from an anonymous donor. That instead, Detman used his own sperm to inseminate Mrs. Lukiewicz. Hyder was born February 13, 1983, and after his birth, the lawsuit says Detman continued to provide gynecological and fertility care to Lukiewicz and never disclosed that it was his own sperm that he used to inseminate her and that Hyder was his biological son. Detman's actions were malicious and intentionally disregarded Lukiewicz's rights, according to the lawsuit, and he also allegedly inseminated other patients, resulting in Hyder's having numerous known and unknown siblings. Increased popularity of DNA testing has resulted in other cases with similar allegations about fertility doctors using their own sperm to secretly inseminate their patients, which many patients and their offspring view as major violation of physicians' ethics and of the inherent trust of the doctor-patient relationship. In one case from the Netherlands, a doctor reportedly became the biological father to dozens of offspring by impregnating his patients. A documentary called Seeds of Deceit was made about the case in 2018. The next article is titled, Rural Arizona Districts Use Housing to Lure Teachers. This article was written by Eric Trevino of the Arizona Republic. School districts in rural Arizona are deploying a new tool in an effort to address the statewide teacher shortage. They're becoming landlords. From Prescott to the reservations in Pima County, schools have begun including affordable housing and teachers' contract to help fill classrooms. Arizona loses double the amount of teachers when compared with the national average, according to state and national data. over 8,600, or about 13%, of Arizona teachers left the profession entirely in the 2024-25 school year, much larger than the national rate of 7.1%. According to a survey from the Arizona Department of Education in 2026, the largest factor contributing to teachers leaving the profession that school year was wanting or needing a higher salary, with roughly 1 in 4 teachers citing compensation as their reason. Working in a rural district is extremely challenging, said Babu Kovari Unified School District Superintendent Ruben Diaz. Not a lot of people, especially young people, want to pack and leave everything behind. Rural schools have instead found a different way to recruit and retain staff, one that will put more teachers, or rather more money in teachers' pockets without having to raise salaries. Superintendent of Prescott Unified School District Clark Tenney said he's lived in Prescott for 43 years and watched it grow from a family town to a retirement community. It's caused the cost of living in Prescott to skyrocket, particularly housing. Tenney said the district pays teachers roughly 5-6% below the state average when he served as the district's human resources director. Tenney said some newly hired teachers backed out after realizing how expensive Prescott was. Data from Zillow, a real estate marketplace, shows the median listing for price for a home in Prescott is over $700,000. The district, through a partnership with the city, allocated funds to build a total of 6 two-bedroom housing units for staff. The units are available for $1,000 a month, which Tenney said is roughly half the market rate. Tenants are allowed to stay in the unit for 1 year, which buys time for new hires to find other housing once the lease ends. The program, he said, has received positive feedback from teachers, giving them a great start and subsequently encouraging them to stay within the district. It's a recruiting tool, but then it also kind of helps with our retention in that we get our top choice candidates and they tend to stay with us, Tenney said. Third grade teacher Rissa Abreu said she found the housing to be a big help during her transition from central Arizona, where the cost of living was cheaper. Even regardless of where you were in life, it's always tough to make a big move. But Prescott has some great kids, and they need great teachers, she said. The housing really makes it more possible for us. Abreu said affordable housing relieves financial pressures, allowing teachers to devote more attention to their work. Ahead of the school year, a fellow district employee living in the units helped her get ready for her first day. She came to help me set up my classroom since I didn't have any family up here anymore, she said. So that was amazing to have a little built-in community right here. The Chino Valley Unified School District in Yavapai County also incorporated teacher housing during a time when finding professionals was an issue. Now its enrollment has steadied and the district has been able to open its one-bedroom units to certified and classified staff for over 650 a month. Originally intended as a 3-year lease, tenants may stay longer depending on their circumstances. Assistant Superintendent of Chino Valley Unified, Marty Campitelli, said the district can offer one of its 10 units as traditional housing for staff who are relocating or going through a divorce. Still, gathering funds to build new housing on district property can be challenging. In Prescott Unified, the district gathered a third of the funds, roughly $500,000, from a federal grant distributed through Arizona Department of Education to be used exclusively for teacher housing. Another third came from the district's own funds, and the last $500,000 came from the city of Prescott in exchange for putting first responders and city personnel in 2 of the 6 units for the next 30 years. In Chino Valley, Campitelli said, the district had received grants to build teacher housing, but they also put in $1 million of their own dollars, which could take the district 2 decades before they repay their debts. He said the district was able to secure some good teachers in the long run through this initiative, but it's not looking to make any future additions. The district also has experienced a decline in enrollment, making the need to hire new teachers less of an issue than when the housing was initially built. The financial commitment is sometimes hard to look at when you're looking at a budget, especially in slimmer times as now. But ultimately, I'm very proud of the fact that we have this. We can offer this to a number of employees, Campitelli said. In Pima County, Bobo-Coari Unified has a total of 41 units for its staff, with plans to expand further, according to Diaz. Housing staff starts at $200 a month and goes up to $350. Employees sign a yearly contract that can be renewed and have the option to choose a one-bedroom, two-bedroom, or three-bedroom unit. Diaz said offering housing allows the district to stay competitive by presenting new hires with their salaries compared to their potential savings. Currently, all 41 units are occupied, with a handful of staff on the waiting list. Bobo-Coari Unified is also looking to expand its housing assistance further by using Impact Aid funds the school district receives from the federal government for establishing buildings on tax-free land like military bases, low-rent housing, and national parks. Because reservations are exempt from taxes, government would have paid in taxes, bringing the district roughly $9 million a year. One of the plans to expand involves purchasing tiny homes from the nearby Globe Unified School District, according to Diaz. After Globe Unified bought the homes and could not get the construction approved, it was willing to sell the Bobo-Coari Unified for an affordable price. Another advantage of the housing, Diaz said, is that teachers who participate in the program tend to stay longer. Not only is it a way for the district to recruit and retain teachers, he said, but it brings financial and emotional stability as teachers fall in love with the community. Once you have a home, that is the root. You connect to that community and you stay with that community, he said.